progressed on the big screen, but no penetration or spark. Cut the claw from the tiger, defang the cobra, so we can feel safe in the dark. Big money makes the decisions, big money owns all the gods, and I can't help but laugh at the puzzled expression when I say I won't give to the cause. And is it any wonder something inside us dies? Is it any wonder that the spirit cries when we sterilize every sacred thing?
I became an environmentalist because of a strong emotional reaction to wild places and the other-than-human world, to beech trees and hedgerows and pounding waterfalls, to songbirds and sunsets, to the flying fish in the Java Sea, and the canopy of the rainforest at dusk when the gibbons come to the waterside to feed. From that reaction came a feeling, which became a series of thoughts, that such things are precious for their own sake, that they are food for the human soul, and that they need people to speak for them to and defend them from other people, because they cannot speak our language, and we have forgotten how to speak theirs, and because we are killing them to feed ourselves, and we know it, and we care about it sometimes, but we do it anyway, because we're hungry, or we've persuaded ourselves that we are. But these are not, I think, very common views today. Today's environmentalism is as much a victim of the contemporary cult of utility as every other aspect of our lives, from science to education. We are not environmentalists now because we have an emotional reaction to the wild world. Most of us wouldn't even know where to find it. We're environmentalists now in order to promote something called sustainability. What does this curious plastic word mean? It does not mean defending the non-human world from the ever-expanding empire of Homo sapiens sapiens, though some of its adherents like to pretend it does, even to themselves. It means sustaining human civilization at the comfort level that the world's rich people, us, feel is their right, without destroying the natural capital or the resource base that is needed to do so. It is, in other words, an entirely human-centered piece of politicking disguised as concern for the planet. In a very short time, just over a decade, this worldview has become all pervasive. It's voiced by the President of the USA and the President of Anglo-Dutch Shell and many people in between. The success of environmentalism has been total at the price of its soul. The environment is the victim of the human empire, but the environment, that distancing word, that empty concept, does not exist. It is the air, the waters, the creatures we make homeless or lifeless in flocks and legions, and it is us too. We are it. We are in it and of it. We make it and live it. We are fruit and soil and tree, and the things done to the roots and the leaves come back to us. We make ourselves slaves to make ourselves free, and when the shackles start to rub, we confidently predict the emergence of new, more comfortable designs.
Paved over meadows for strip malls, or misguided notions of bliss. And I point to the universe, shaking their shoulders, saying, how can you need more than this? 5,000 years of repression, 5,000 years of the lie. And I can't help but hoping as I'm watching the changes that maybe we're watching it die.
This is an essay that I wrote after about 15 years of being an environmental activist, being an activist on the front lines, also working for NGOs, writing about green issues, trying to think this stuff through. And seeing the green movement change in that time, and also coming to the conclusion, and it was a very difficult conclusion to admit to myself, but I think a lot of people are starting to admit it to themselves now, coming to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that we're facing can't be solved in the sense that we would like to solve them. For example, we're not going to stop the climate changing. We're not going to stop the mass extinction event that we're in at the moment. Hopefully we can prevent it from getting any worse than it has to get, but we're in it and it's happening and it's too late to do a lot of things about it. And meanwhile, the green movement, which I suppose sprang to life in the 60s as a very radical challenge to the industrial system, and which presented a very different way of looking at the world, the most radical new idea, I suppose, for hundreds of years, really, more radical than anything Marx came up with, in my view, is this thing that we might call ecocentrism, which is that our value systems should – encompass the world beyond the human. They should encompass life itself rather than simply the interest of those of our species. It's a very difficult thing to put into practice, but it is a very good thing to aim for. And that was what the environment movement was aiming for when it came into being. And it was also aiming to really wind back much of the damage done by the industrial system. But over the last 30 or 40 years, environmentalism has been probably inevitably sucked into that system. And two things, briefly, two things in particular, I think, have happened that have bothered me, and I think which have really neutered the radical challenge of environmentalism. Firstly, it's been sucked in by the market. And if you listen to a lot of environmentalists now in the mainstream, and obviously I'm generalizing here in this essay and in this call, when I talk about environmentalism, I'm really talking about the kind of popular environmentalism that you'll hear from the NGOs and the Green Parties and the media figures and the people who have influence in government and business. But environmentalism has become a market now. It's become a carbon market. It's become a technological way to make a huge amount of money trying to stop climate change or invent new trees that will suck the carbon from the air and put the wind farms all over the mountains and all the rest of it. And that has become what we call sustainability, which again was originally a radical word and has now become a word which seems to mean sustaining industrial civilization through the use of technologies which don't emit carbon, and is no kind of radical challenge at all. So that's the first problem. The second one, I think, is that the Greens have allowed themselves to be identified with the political left far too much. And the political left's job, its historic challenge, is human equality and the fair distribution of resources. And my point is not that those are bad things, but that they're very different things from the original Green idea of bringing about a challenge that looks more widely than simply at human interest. And because the Greens have allowed themselves to be dominated by the left, if you like, I find that the original ecocentric narrative, the beyond human narrative, has almost completely disappeared. And what we end up with, again, as I say, in the mainstream, is a kind of bleached out environmentalism.
Maybe a hurricane's coming, or maybe it's just a soft rain. And I don't have the answers, but every part of my being is laughing or crying or screaming for change. And is it any wonder that the spirit prays? Is it any wonder something inside us dies when we sanitize every sacred thing? Every sacred thing. Every sacred thing. Every sacred thing. Every sacred thing.
I don't have any answers. If by answers we mean political systems, better machines, means of engineering some grand shift in consciousness. All I have is a personal conviction built on those feelings, those responses, that goes back to the moors of northern England and the rivers of southern Borneo, that something big is being missed. That we are both hollow men and stuffed men, and that we will keep stuffing ourselves until the food runs out. And if outside the dining room door we have made a wasteland and called it necessity, then at least we will know we are not to blame. Because we are never to blame, because we are the humans.
Long lines of men and women, children in hand, arms full of parcels and bags, the roads jammed, cars parked and abandoned, a fine orange dust rising, fire in the hills. Smoke seeps from books and earth cracks. One woman read aloud. People wiped their eyes, seeking some last mythic oasis. A desperate fish leapt from the sea and, like a letter from a lover, brought hope. Ashes rained and twirled, machines churned up brakes, clang of steel, cathedral chant, dust of stones, robot hum, soldiers crowded in the surf, fire ants on the move.
No right. like it's gonna fly that high. There's no escaping, the enemy is you and I. We poison up the water, we're choking on the air. Let's stop before it gets too late, or is it already too late? Is it already too late for the victims of comfort?
I'm not interested in what is best for the economy. I'm interested in what is best for the Colorado River. I'm really interested in what is best for the Smith River here where I live. I'm really interested in what's best for the salmon. I'm really interested in what's best for the land base. One of my books, What We Leave Behind, the central question of that book is, or the central answer of that book is understanding that the measure by which we'll be judged and the measure by which we should be judged is, do we leave the world a better place by having been here? And by world, I don't mean capitalism. I don't mean industrial civilization. I mean the real physical world. And this is a really important topic for environmentalism, because in the past 30 years or so, past 40 years, whatever, a lot of the environmental movement has been completely hijacked away from being about protecting wild places and wild creatures and wild plants, to being about perpetuating the culture for a little bit longer. So this is how you can get just this whole sort of high-tech sustainability movement that has nothing to do with sustainability. That's not about sustaining the real world, helping the real world to sustain itself. It's all about sustaining this destructive culture. And that's a terrible, terrible hijack. I think it's desperately important for us to think very clearly about to whom we are loyal. If you are loyal to the agricultural industry in Arizona and Las Vegas and Nevada, and the agricultural industry and the cities in Southern California, then it can make sense to dewater the Colorado River. But if your loyalty is to the river and those non-humans and humans who actually depend upon the river, then you will make entirely different decisions. There's a great line by R.D. Lang about how we perceive the world affects how we behave in the world. And if you perceive the world as consisting of industrial civilization and the real world is getting a job, then you're going to behave in one way. But if the real world is your own embodied life and the embodied life of the forest and the embodied life of the river, then you're going to have an entirely different set of responses.
We're just the victims of comfort, connoisseurs of pain. It's a technological merry-go-round, dangerous solutions buried under the ground. And everyone likes a party, but no one wants to clean. Well, I'd like to see a change somehow, but I'm a little busy right now. Just a little busy right now. I'm just a victim of comfort. I got no one else to blame.
And this goes to the heart of the liberal versus radical question, that radical really means going to the roots of something. And the liberal model and the neoliberal model are both based on individualism. And how this affects your desire for, or how you believe social change takes place, is really crucial. That the liberal would believe that the way by which social change takes place is through individual education. That if we can just make personal changes, and if we can just then propagate these personal changes to others, that will somehow affect society. And a radical believes that, yeah, education is important, of course, but the real point is to change the social means of propagating power, and that the problem is not that the CEO just doesn't understand that the river is a living being. The problem is that the CEO is socially rewarded by the mechanisms of power in society for destroying the river. And the radical believes that, well, education plays a role. The primary point is to change or destroy the means of oppressive power. It's like my friend Lior Keith always says, the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to take down those systems of oppressive authority. And it's an entirely different approach, really, in that it comes from the understanding that there are no personal solutions to social problems. This leads one down an entirely different path than believing that one can solve social problems through personal solutions. And this is tied into also the notion that the 1980s were really the first time that the corporate newspapers called citizens consumers more often than it called them citizens. And this is really important too, because if you can convince people that they are consumers, then their choices of resistance are either buy or don't buy. If you understand that you're a citizen and not a consumer, then your choices are buy, not buy, organize, don't organize, petition, boycott, and when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, except I would say it's the responsibility. And my point is that you can revolt. And then there's another transformation that took place several thousand years ago, which I think is just as crucial and just as wrenching, which is when we were convinced to become citizens as opposed to human animals who need community and who need habitat. Because if you're a human animal with claws and teeth, you will defend that habitat and you will defend your community to the death, as opposed to if you're a citizen, you've been convinced that the government is supposed to take care of everything.
Oh, and what do we got to lose? Everything. Yes, and what do we stand to gain? Everything. So let's try together before we have to cry together. It's too soon to die together. I'm just a victim of comfort. Got no one else to blame. I'm just a victim of comfort.
Up until now, everything around here has always been, well, pleasant. Recently, certain things have become unpleasant.
Somebody brings up the topic of climate change, I just need to say, we're fucked.
The prophet took my hand on Old Souls Day. He preached the value of deception. Changing shadows by shapeshifters' rules. Tales are never just for fools. The court of conscience came before me.
I'm frequently accused of not being a climate scientist. I plead guilty. For one thing, there's almost no such degree, even today, at universities and colleges around the country. Most people who claim to be climate scientists don't have a degree in climate science. The discipline only arose as a formal discipline within the last few years. My undergraduate degree is in forestry, how to cut down every single tree and turn it into lumber. My graduate degrees, master's and PhD, were in range science, which is how to destroy the other aspects of the terrestrial planet beyond the forests. In fact, within the range science curriculum where I received my PhD, we referred to the PhD as the post-hole digger. My point, and I do have one, is that if you want to find a climate scientist, look no further than James Hansen, as one example, a man who has degrees in physics and astronomy, not climate science. We have great latitude in universities and some government positions with respect to the scholarship we do. That certainly applies in almost every tenured university position. There's great latitude in the research that is conducted. Whether a person studies climate change, or how to sustain civilization, or social criticism of some part of their work, as long as it fits into the general framework of their department or their academic home, there's really not a lot of pressure put on tenured faculty members with respect to what they study. So I don't claim to be a climate scientist. I'm a conservation biologist. I study speciation and extinction events and what causes species to go extinct. That gives me a unique perspective in the study of climate science as opposed to, say, physicists and astronomers. I study life and what sustains life. I am not the climate scientist, and that's okay. I think, in fact, that's a pretty good thing. At the edge of extinction, beyond speciation, only love remains.
I would go deeper to the root than that. It's not merely capitalism. It's socialism, too. It's every ism you want. It's civilization. It's civilization. The first civilizations arose a few thousand years ago, seven of them simultaneously on different continents. And at that moment, civilization became a cul-de-sac. It became a death trap. It became a patriarchal set of living arrangements that drove us into human population overshoot. And civilization was a cul-de-sac, but it wasn't a one-way street. In fact, there are at least three cultures, the Mimbres, the Olmec, and the Chaco, that when civilization failed, and here I'll use the example of the Mimbres near where I live, the Mimbres gained access to a cheap energy source known as maize or corn nearly 1,000 years ago after having lived in the area for about 10,000 years. And within 20 years, they were so deep in human population overshoot, and then they had a drought, and they ate the seed cone, ate the seed corn. 20 years after they began civilization by growing grains, they collapsed catastrophically, and a few survivors walked away. And the survivors that came back didn't do corn ever again. They didn't do civilization. They didn't store grains to get them through the hard times. Civilization is not a one-way street. The Olmec did the same thing. The Mimbres, the Chaco, all these cultures collapsed. And when they returned from that, they went back to hunting and gathering, not to civilization. Industrial civilization is a one-way street. Industrial civilization, we can't go back anymore since 1939, since we invented nuclear Armageddon. There's no going back. If we cease this set of living arrangements at this point, the world's 400 and some nuclear power plants melt down catastrophically and we're all dead in a month. So we can't terminate industrial civilization until we shut down the nuclear power plants. It takes at least 20 years to decommission a nuclear power plant. There was a panel in New York City which included the ex-head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in this country, and they concluded that it would take at least 60 years to decommission Indian Point, the nuclear power plant right outside of New York City. At least 60 years. So we can't see civilization that is making us fat, making us sick, and killing us. Because if we do, we're all dead in a short period of time. Consider, for example, Fukushima Daiichi. So we can't reverse industrial civilization at this point. It took me a long time to figure that out. So we have to maintain industrial civilization, which is killing us through climate change. So getting at the root, it's all about civilization, and it's a trap. And at this point, it's a one-way street. It's a trap, and we're already caught. There's no escape.
How the market is not like a tropical forest. When layers of leaves, high canopy, mid-level broads and fans, short shrubs below, where herbs beneath them and moss on the floor catch light. Fungi in the soil recycle it all back to the top. Every conceivable niche is filled or overfilled. divinely superfluous beauty. In the market, everyone targets the center. It levels to a three-body problem with strange attractors looping in useless eddies. Work is taxed, capital let free to accumulate and be skimmed off. More like an overgrazed pasture where each generation of Forb is poorer than the last. It's an act of conjuring. The only real product is money, some money. The invisible hand is in your pocket.
Story mind, it thinks about urgency and efficiency, and part of me says, well, yeah, let's not try to be efficient when it comes to what I could morally judge as bad things. But then with what I could judge as good things, let's say environmental restoration or direct action or, you know, things to halt these, you know, catastrophic events, and I go, oh no, we should be efficient, we should be urgent. And it's difficult for me to relinquish the logic of the cause and effect or the possibility that direct resistance can help derail the destruction. So,
yeah,
you know, I'm...
How's it been working so far?
Well, it's exhausting and depressing, and yeah, I mean, it obviously hasn't been.
Yeah, like, I'm not actually saying that there's never a time for urgent, linear, direct action. I think that there is, but I think that we overuse that that way of addressing problems. If I see, you know, my baby about to fall off a wall onto the concrete, I'll urgently rush over to catch him. You know, if I see him wandering out in front of a car that's speeding down the road, I'll urgently run out there and grab him. There are times if I know exactly what to do and my personal force is enough to solve the problem, then, yeah, why not? You know, all of our capacities are here for a reason. But I think that the situation we face isn't like that. We don't know what to do right now. And all of the things we have been doing have been, at best, won isolated victories in this tide of defeat and have often been counterproductive. You know, like going out and protesting things, it can become kind of almost perfunctory. And you go out there and you tell yourself you're doing something about it, but it's kind of like following a script. And there's the category of the protester. The system has a place for that category. People's conceptual universe has a place for the protester, and the system knows what to do with it. It's not actually very disruptive.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that it's never disruptive or always ineffectual, but sometimes there's the motive of showing oneself that at least I'm doing something about it, or gaining kind of an identity from doing those things. And I think that we just need to take a pause sometimes. And then, as you know, in the book, I write a lot about disrupting the story as a foundational principle of activism. And because the story goes so deep, we could sometimes end up disrupting it on one level, but affirming it on a deeper level. So we could maybe disrupt the story that fracking is perfectly fine and doesn't hurt anybody, while contributing to the story that there are these evil guys out there who need to be conquered, the frackers. and they're just doing it because they're bad, you know, and there's this evil thing in human nature that we need to go to war against. So we could be strengthening the mentality of hatred and war, even as we're trying to use the tactics of hatred and war to achieve something that's beautiful to us. So one of the things I work with is a call to action, to disruptive action that disrupts on every level, not just the superficial level.
If the stuff that I bring up and talk about that you really don't like, and with luck I'm going to do that, use that as an opportunity to come to your own conclusions about the issue. Because the issues that I bring up, I think you're all going to agree are real issues. My response, interpretation, and deconstruction of those issues is going to be very influenced by my anarchist past, my anarchist present, my aging hippiness, and a complete, profound commitment to opposing the patriarchy, to opposing fascism, and a commitment to the alleviation of suffering.
Like the hidden world that creates mysteries, the mycelial network, a metaphor that's become very useful to all of us, hasn't it? Because we understand that there's a network beneath the surface that nourishes and informs everything above the surface. Thankfully, we have the underground. No matter what becomes legal, I hope we always have the underground, because I just think it's a great medium of wondering and communication and creativity. Do you know how much information this extended community has kept pretty much to themselves while making fantastic things happen? It's really great. I really appreciate the underground. And as someone said to me many, many years ago, well, isn't it what holds everything up?
Basically, it's a software program. The software programs that we inherit from our family, and I like to use the term software program rather than belief system, because software program gives you kind of an immediate sense of how it alters behavior, because that's what software does. It produces certain behaviors when your computer is oriented by the software. So when we take in these various software programs, then it changes what we can perceive in the world. So, you know, a very easy one is people with really dark colored skin at one time were considered to be unable to reason as well as people with light colored skin. It's not something that was questioned by a lot of people. It's just what was so. And scientists were some of the most active people in creating that software program, and you would see even stuff, common things that, you know, black-skinned people were an intermediate life form between chimpanzees and light-colored skinned people. And so they were looking for this sort of evolutionary pyramid thing, which we're still influenced by to a tremendous extent. And another one, women weren't considered to be as equal as men because they didn't think the same way and things like that. So once that's absorbed, it alters the subsequent behavior that you engage in. And most people just never thought about the software programs until something forced them to. But it's much more insidious than that, because we tend to think of plants as insentient beings, or bacteria as insentient beings, but they're really not very bright and they're stupid, and so we can do what we want because we're really smart. You know, when I hear people talking like this, I always go, like, how many people have you met? Don't you ever read the news? It's like, I just can't buy this whole thing, like, that we're the smartest species on the planet. You know, it's not working for me. So that's the thing. People buy these things, buy into it because they're children. They don't really have a lot of choice. It's hammered into them year after year after year. And once that happens, what they can perceive of the world around them is very, very limited, unless some event occurs to force the gating channels to open, and they'll have kind of a epiphany of some sort, and then they'll begin to shift those gating systems.
Far enough, there's a history of the witch burnings. Most of the witches that were burnt were actually healers that were burnt. One of the bits of evidence that the church used to demonstrate being in some relationship with the devil was that if a woman, because women were not allowed education, if a woman was able to heal somebody and they didn't have the right training, because they couldn't have the right training because they couldn't read, the only way they could do that would be because the devil was doing the work for them. So if you were healing with herbs and you weren't given permission by the power elite, if you weren't a doctor, just the fact of healing somebody with herbs, if you were in the wrong century, in the wrong town, you were going to get burnt for it.
That's from the garden to the farthest prayer made of stardust. Find your healing in the music that calls you, the voice that enthralls you. What do you belong to? I doubt there's the setting of the sun. Give thanks to each and every one. The lesson is the medicine woman, medicine man. Walk in with grace, I know your face, and I trust your hands. Medicine woman, medicine man.
The word radical. Now, I always have to look this one up because there are different ways of spelling radical. This is the botanical way of spelling radical. And the radical is the growing root tip of a bean sprout. The growing basal cap of the root, which is one of the strongest forces in nature. Without the botanical radicals, soil wouldn't work properly. It wouldn't be aerated. There wouldn't really be life in the soil. It's the radical of the growing plants which are turning the soil and allowing stuff to happen. If you've ever seen an oak tree or any tree growing through a boulder which is cracked in half, I'm sure you've all seen this. It's not growing through a cracked in half boulder. It cracked the boulder in half and it was in the way, so it came through. Have you ever seen shepherd's purse or something equivalent breaking a sidewalk? It didn't grow in the crack. It produced the crack from underneath. Very quiet, very low key, not on the surface very radical, but if we weren't spraying sidewalks all the time, it would just take a few years for things as simple and as profound as a shepherd's purse to completely recycle the concrete. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things. The school system is basically about 100 years out of date. And Bucky Fuller made that point. He said churches run 500 years behind the times, you know, schools 100 years behind the times, and so on. And I thought it was fascinating because right after I read that, the Catholic Church reopened the heresy case against Galileo and found him innocent, you know, but it was like about 500 years to the day, you know, that happened. So that thing is, you know, that whole dynamic about us being the most intelligent people, about this entropy thing and all of that stuff, it's basically just not accurate. And it came out of old viewpoints in England, really, in the 19th century, when they were kind of the apex of scientific study. But it's just when you start to get that you live in a world where every living organism has a neural network as sophisticated or sometimes even more so than our own, that they have greater neural net capacity than we do, that in essence their brain is significantly larger, even though they might not have an organ that looks like the brain, they'll have a neural network that is very, very similar to our own. Once you start getting all of that, it not only undermines the entire reductive worldview, but it's terrifying to people who don't really know how to reach outside of themselves and communicate with another life form, even other human beings.
And I think it's one of the reasons why our culture has such a hard time coping with herbalists, is that one of the many reasons they have a hard time coping with herbalists is that we bridge so many realms, we bridge so many worlds, and when we're on a good day, we bridge those worlds really well. And let's acknowledge we all have bad days, but on the good days, we are, as a movement, as a field, characterized by synergy, characterized by cooperation between plants and humans, between practitioners and their patients. No therapeutic endeavor can possibly be value-free. It's just, we pretend it can be. You know, we're either just treating the hemorrhoid or dispensing something. Actually, any time that you're involved in the transformative work of real healing, facilitating the plants doing the real healing, we're involved in a very profoundly radical transformation of the human soil. Involved in a profound marriage between the plants and humans and everything else. Actually, working at the interface, which is the evidence of the fact that we are all one. Herbalism is ecology in practice. So anytime you give anybody herbs, anytime you take herbs, anytime you talk to people about herbs, you're being profoundly radical, profoundly transformative, profoundly irritating to the dominant paradigm.
People have been so inculcated in a lot of these beliefs. It's like in the United States now, we only have a choice between Christianity and science, and those are the kind of two monolithic belief systems that have been fighting it out. You know, neither one is exactly useful in its present form. But the thing that happens in the school system, there's this sort of thing like, oh, we have to be rigorous, we have to do this, we have to, you know, be based on science and this fundamental stuff. But the problem is they're still using models that are extremely old, and everybody's inculcated in that belief system. So everybody has seen parents shut down their children. I mean, like, if children say, well, that plant over there is sad, you know, the parents will go, oh, honey, plants don't have feelings. It's a really common thing for children to be told. And so it sort of starts earlier, because the invisible world is something people don't know much about, and they're afraid to encourage it in their children, because they also don't understand children very well for the most part. But really, once you get into the school system and they start dividing all of the subjects up into blocks, like chemistry this time, physics this time, you know, and you start having these sort of separate divisions, and the children become inculcated in this experience of the world being basically dead, and just it's sort of a resource that human beings can use. And it has to happen over and over again. Children naturally experience the world as alive and intelligent and aware. They have to be trained over and over and over out of that belief before we finally let go. And the longer we go into the school system, the longer we're in there, the worse it gets, until finally a lot of people graduate from college, and however long they've gone in it, they just don't know who they are anymore. They experience life as meaningless, and hence the Prozac industry.
As the world burns, the old masters, we hear, avoided challenging the status quo, as they also avoided contact with women and refrained from social activism. Considering the crimes of history, the Buddha wondered what to do. Thus, we sit, pursuing personal self-cultivation, serenity as proof of some transcendental virtue. In the great Kalpa fire, when all is consumed, is it consumed as well? Sit with this. Outside, the peasants pass buckets hand to hand.
And in the gray light that shapes the dawn, we see the things that we believe in. Light is substance and shadow form. Such sweet darkness to shape the things that we believe in. Oh, maiden mama crone, oh, maiden mama crone, oh, maiden mama crone.
So the basic premise of my work is that our world is built on a story, a mythology, or even that our world is a story. Understanding that that itself is a story, but one that's been useful to me in understanding things. So, like, on a pretty obvious level, things like nation states, corporations, money, they don't have any physical reality except what we create through our agreements about them. So you could very easily say that those things are a story. And even our understanding of how change happens in the world, what a self is, what's important in life, all of these things are conditioned by the narratives that we grow up in. So basically, the story of separation is what I call this underlying meta-narrative or mythology that says, yeah, who you are is a separate being in a world of other, kind of like this bubble of psychology bouncing around inside a flesh robot, and separate from other selves out there, and fundamentally separate from nature too, in that there are these generic particles out there, these masses, these arbitrary forces of nature that we need to protect ourselves against and someday master and overcome and transcend and rise above nature. So this is all part of the story of separation, separate from each other, separate from nature. And it's a story that isn't working very well anymore, at least. Maybe we once could pretend that it was working well and that we were on the verge of, you know, finally conquering nature, transcending death, synthesizing food, going off into space and achieving technological utopia. But that's getting harder and harder to maintain that pretense. And the crises that are built on that story, first and foremost, the ecological crisis that comes from seeing nature as just a bunch of stuff, that crisis is ejecting us from that story into first, like you said, the space between stories where we don't know what's real anymore. We don't know what's true anymore. We don't know who we are anymore, maybe as individuals, maybe as a species. And then into a new and actually very ancient story that offers different answers to those questions. Who are you? Well, the totality of all my relationships, a mirror of all of nature, a mirror of the cosmos. What's important to contribute to something greater than myself? So it offers a completely different navigating system and understanding of who we are and the way the world is. So that, for example, it becomes obvious that what we do to the world, we do to ourselves because we're not separate from the world. What happens to another being is happening to us inescapably, no matter how high a wall we build between us and no matter how developed our technologies of insulating and controlling are. It can't protect us because what's happening to the whales is happening to us inescapably. So that's the basic picture.
To shape the things that we believe in.
In the transition is to know that ecosystems are collapsing, species have been driven to extinction, economies are collapsing everywhere, entire societies, like in Syria, if half your people are living in refugee camps somewhere else, you know, that's a collapse. It's a social collapse. I think in the towns of Baltimore and in the towns of Missouri, we see a social collapse. But the key is not to respond to either fear or panic or hate. Because that is what is triggered for those who would like to maintain power in this period. When I hear the speeches of your presidential candidates, you know, based on fear and hate, they are actually making sure there can't be a transition. So the transition needs, instead of fear, it needs hope. Instead of hate, it needs love. The second is that this transition cannot happen while we think piecemeal. We all have limits. Either I can start a garden, or I can be a good teacher, or I can be a wilderness protector. But even while we play our little role in our care for the earth, we have to be deeply aware of the web of life. And it's only when we see those interconnections at every step, we will stop doing what society has done for too long, competing with each other. Climate movement competing with the agricultural regeneration movement, the labor movement having to compete with the environmental movement. Too long have we been pitted against each other by those who thrive on divide and rule. The third very, very important aspect of the transition is, you know, 250 years of paradigms in economy and science and technology have literally groomed generations to think that, oh my God, what's going to happen if I don't have a job? Oh my God, what's going to happen when we run out of oil? Oh my God, what's going to happen if I've got to return to the village? What's going to happen when there's no electricity? The only way we'll make this transition is by looking at small farmers and their societies, looking at indigenous people and their societies, first developing respect for them, not looking down on them as primitive, but realizing that they created a very, very large footprint with a very high culture. We can only make this transition as an earth family. We can only make this transition through the joy of living, not being married to the junk that industrial society has created.
Baby, you and I've got a lot to learn.